Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power, Dell, and AVU Technologies. Now here's your host, Ward Morrow.
Today we'll be joined by AFGE National Council of SSA Field Operations Locals President Witold Skirtinski, Local 2798 member Joseph Rydell, and Partnership for Public Service Vice President of Education and Outreach Tim McManus. Welcome back to Inside Government, Witold.
How you doing?
So AFG recently won an FLRA decision regarding employee leave policies at the Social Security Teleservices Center. Tell us a little about that.
Okay, yes. So we filed a national grievance regarding leave practices in our teleservice centers. The agency unilaterally decided that employees who worked in our teleservice centers, who answered the 800 number calls from the public, that they would only allow a small percentage of them at any one time off, 10 or 15% of the employees, depending on the anticipated call volume of those of the day. And this was a large change from the past and is quite different from any leave practice that Social Security has for the rest of the agency. Our contract stated that they have to make every reasonable effort to allow as many people off as possible on any given day, and we felt that imposing an arbitrary percentage restriction violated the contract. They were unable to provide any rationale on why they chose those particular percentages, 10 and 15%. They appear to have not done any studies or any conducted any focus groups or anything else which would cause them to come up with these restrictions. So we filed a grievance and won. The arbitrator ruled that the restrictions violated the contract and they should be lifted. And the agency appealed. So by appealing under the law, they stayed the decision. So they continued to engage in this behavior which violated the contract while the FLRA was considering their appeal. And a couple of weeks ago, the FLRA ruled that their appeal had no merit and that the arbitrator's award should be implemented.
Now, let me try to understand this. When you say leave, are you including both sick leave and annual leave in that?
Well, the agency's decision to restrict leave was based on annual leave, but individual teleservice managers, some of them interpreted as including all types of leave, including sick leave. So if people were on sick leave, or if people and they anticipated sick leave in advance, or if they had under alternative work schedules, if they had a day off on their 549 schedule, they would take that into account as they could only allow 10 or 15% of people off for any reason on any given day, which even reduced more people's ability to get leave. So you can understand, like during holiday periods, for instance, Christmas or Thanksgiving, you had very few people in our teleservice centers who were allowed any leave. Now, we have 36 teleservice centers around the country, and they're filled with about 5,000 people who answer the 800 number. So the agency, was allowing very few of them a leave at any given time. So oftentimes, you know, you're in a situation where you have use or lose in the federal government. You can't carry over more than 240 hours of leave into another year. So you had to use leave. And oftentimes people were forced to take leave during periods where they didn't even want it. But rather than lose it, they were forced to do that because of these artificial restrictions.
Now, how bad was it? I mean, we heard reports that in some situations, people had to bring in obituaries for bereavement leave.
Right. Some managers went over the top in demanding evidence that people actually needed leave when they were hitting their percentages. So, right, we've had instances where, and that came out in the hearing, in the arbitration hearing, where where individual managers demanded obits or death certificates or proof that somebody actually had to go to a funeral.
Now, other than Astru's just apparent anti-union bias, is there any reason why management would implement such a restrictive leave policy?
Well, I mean, I can't tell you what management was thinking, but they had, you know, there's a lot of people, there's been an increasing volume of people that call the 800 number, and the agency for a long time, because of budgets, was unable to hire sufficient people to answer, not only answer the 800 number, but to do the rest of the government work. It's only since the Obama administration, where we've had some significant increases in staff in the fiscal year 09 and fiscal year 10 budgets. Previous to that, I guess the agency felt that rather than have a rational leave policy, they would have more people answering the phones if they had these restrictions.
And let's describe how a teleservice center works and what it looks like to people. It's a large area, hundreds of people working at them. How many of them are there?
There's different sizes. You know, we have small ones like in Hawaii. There's a teleservice center with 15 people. And then we have what they range up to what we call mega teleservice centers, where we have four of those in Auburn, Washington. There's one in Baltimore, Maryland, in Birmingham, Alabama, and in Albuquerque, New Mexico. They all have around 600 employees. And it's a nationwide system. So it's wherever you happen to be located in these 36 spots, when somebody calls in on the 800 number, they're routed to the first available agent. So that person, yeah, if you're calling from Washington, D.C., you may get an agent in Richmond, California. You may get an agent in New York City. You may get an agent in Chicago. It really depends on who's next available. That's another thing about their policy. Their policy was by facility, but the calls don't come in by facility. They come in the first available agent. So if you're going to have any kind of a leave policy, it ought to be for the teleservice centers as a whole. But their policy dealt with individual ones and had really nothing to do with the needs of the agency in that particular facility.
Now, in addition to this big win, you've also got to deal with the SSA Council and contract negotiations with management and Commissioner Astru. As we've been saying in previous shows, we know he's shown himself to not be a friend of labor. How are these negotiations going?
Poorly. We've been at the table for 13 months, and we have not agreed to anything really substantive. So we have sought the aid of the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service and a mediator. Our contract negotiations resume next week, and a mediator has been assigned from the FMCS to attend the negotiations and to try to get the parties to reach some agreements. So we're hopeful that mediation. The union was the party who was attempting to get mediation to intervene. The agency actually was opposed to having mediation at this point in the bargaining process. But they are coming. A mediator is coming next week. So hopefully that'll change the tenor and substance of the negotiations. And we're hopeful that he'll help us at least come to some agreements.
You think it'd be easier just to go straight to the FISA panel? The panel just make a decision?
Well, the way the, you know, in the federal sector, since we can't go on strike, negotiation disputes, if you have a negotiation dispute, there's an agency, the Federal Services Impasses Panel, where you can send your disputes, and they use various techniques to decide on the substance of the dispute, which contract language prevails. We can't go there without the mediation step. One of the requirements is that a mediator has to declare an impasse. So we have to go through mediation, and we're hopeful that the mediator will help us reach some agreements. We think it's very unrealistic to take. We have 50 articles on the table, and we haven't agreed to any at this point. And we think it would be unlikely that the Federal Services Impasse panel would even deal with a 50-article package. So we really need to try to hash out and figure out how to resolve, you know, the bulk of the contract. And if we don't reach agreement on some key issues, we're certainly prepared to go to the panel and seek their assistance.
And can you tell us about the status of increased flex time, credit hour use, telework opportunities? It seems like those kind of things would be very useful to SSA.
Well, we did surveys with the employees before we started negotiations. We started in December of 2009, and we did surveys before that. And the employees informed us of the issues that they were most interested in. And the issues that you mentioned, flex time, credit hours, and telework, were in the top 15 issues that employees wanted us to address in the contract. So we have concentrated on that. And the way these things are handled really depends on what part of the agency you work in. I'm the chief negotiator of the contract, so I'm concerned about, you know, all parts of the agency. But in my day-to-day job, I represent people who work in field offices, our 1,300 field offices, and our 36 teleservice centers. And the people who work in those facilities have less flex time opportunities and credit hour opportunities than people who work in the rest of the agency. So part of our proposals are to try to expand flex time. And in credit hours, we want more flexibility, more ability to use credit hours within the pay period that they're earned. There are some legal restrictions, but the agency has opposed any changes in these areas at all. They haven't agreed to any improvements in either of these areas. With regards to telework, although the president and the current administration is pushing telework as an option to deal with situations like hazardous weather and to deal with space costs and to allow more flexibility for workers to do their jobs, Social Security appears to be opposed not only to expansion of telework, but to even having the current levels of telework. It took them a year to even counter our initial proposal on telework. And we received their counter proposal last month. And there are so many restrictions in their proposal, and there's so many demands that management can make unilateral decisions that it's difficult for us to engage in a rational debate about it. I mean, we're so our positions are diametrically different. Their attitude is that they would like each individual manager to be able to make decisions on how many people they can allow work at home, who those people are, what days they can work, how many days they can work. And currently, where we do have telework, that's all negotiated. We have negotiated agreements which delineated all that. And their proposal is that they wouldn't negotiate any of that. They would just get to make the calls. And they have certain restrictions in there which would inhibit people to work telework, such as a fixed shift. People would have to work a fixed shift when they're teleworking, and we think that's illegal because in the same pay period, you'd have some days you'd have a fixed shift and other days you'd be on flex time. So we think their proposal has some legal problems in it. And they also would ban people from having their being able to work on their assigned telework day if they take any leave the day before. So if you're sick and you call in sick, you would be punished by losing your telework day. I mean, that's the attitude they have about the process. They want to put in barriers where people would be inhibited to work. They have also demands to visit people's houses without notice to check to see if they're actually in if they're gaming the system. It's an attitude that they have of mistrust, a basic attitude which is throughout the contract negotiations that we've witnessed, is that there's a basic mistrust of the worker. And the agency wants to do things and subject workers to high levels of scrutiny because they don't trust them. And there's no evidence to show that you can't trust the workforce and Social Security. In fact, we're known throughout government as one of the better agencies, one of the better workforces in government. And the nature of the job is that, you know, you're dealing with the public on a day-to-day basis. So it's kind of an intense and stressful job, and our people are dedicated and professional employees. So this kind of attitude that the agency has is puzzling.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Attention AFGE members, government and military employees, looking for a hassle-free way to buy a new computer, electronics, or home appliances? Purchasing Power allows you to get items such as Dell laptops, HP desktops, and Kenmore appliances through easy payroll deduction. There's no upfront cash required, no credit checks, and AFGE members get a 6% discount. Get started today. Log on to shoppurchasingpower.com. That's shoppurchasingpower.com.
Save 10, 20, even 30% on PCs from Dell. Only Dell can offer AFGE members the guaranteed lowest price through their member purchase program. Visit Dell.com/AFGE for details.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We're continuing with Witold Skierczynski, the president of AFGE, National Council of SSA Field Operations Locals. We're talking about the collective bargaining negotiations going on with Social Security. We're talking a little about telework. And, you know, we had on Congressman Sarbanes just a few weeks ago talking about the new telework legislation. It sounds like the problems you're having at SSA is getting those kinds of things implemented on the ground. My understanding is you're also fighting to restore fairness to the grievance and arbitration process. Let's talk a little about that.
Yes, our grievance procedure, we would like to have things in our grievance procedure, such as a alternative dispute resolution process. Understanding the whole purpose of the grievance procedure is to resolve disputes. I mean, in a unionized environment, you know, there are going to be disputes, differences of interpretation of our contract and how the agency implements government-wide rules and regulations and laws. So we have a grievance procedure, which is designed to try to resolve those disputes. And it's our view that, you know, we should have the grievance procedure should be relatively informal at its beginning stages so that you can have a dialogue about the issues which cause a dispute and try to reach, you know, mutual understandings with the grievance official. It's a three-step process, and then a fourth step would be arbitration. What the agency's proposed is all kinds of requirements for the content of the grievance, which if aren't met, they would declare the grievance as void because you haven't added enough specificity, enough specific references to government-wide rules and regulations that were violated, citations of statutes that you're saying were violated, and specific contract references that are in the grievance, and also a requirement to list every single party who might be a part of the grievance. Now, the union, you know, for instance, the union has in the past gotten relief for classes of people who've been aggrieved. For instance, we filed a nationwide grievance on the Fair Labor Standards Act and the agency's violation of the Fair Labor Standards Act, and the agency had to pay over $100 million in back pay and damages to people who they hadn't paid overtime properly. Now, under the agency proposal, we would have to, in advance, list everyone who might be aggrieved, which is impossible if you're filing a class grievance of that nature. And they, under the agency's proposal, we would have to be so specific in any grievance, and that absent that specificity, the grievance would be void. Now, we have, you know, I have 1,300 offices that I represent, but we have stewards, local reps in each office, with various levels of training. Many of them haven't been trained, and they're, you know, they just go in and are trying to resolve a dispute, and to force them to engage in that kind of specificity is not a proposal that is intended to deal with improving the grievance process, but is a proposal to give the agency the opportunity to say, well, I won this case because you weren't specific enough. So that's a problem. Arbitration, they're proposing a requirement that all cases that we request arbitration now, we have to do within 6 months, have a hearing. Well, it's impossible. I mean, we grieve hundreds of cases. We'd have to have hire a bevy of attorneys or train non-attorneys to be able to do all these cases. And it's just a proposal to prevent a grievant from having their final opportunity in an arbitration case. So we've proposed what we think are more reasonable timeframes, lengthier timeframes in terms of doing arbitration cases, and we've proposed less restrictive language on what has to be in the content of a grievance. We've also proposed ADR processes, which the agency has opposed.
And, you know, as you get into the fairness issue, I guess one of the other issues you got to take up are merit promotions and protection from manager abuse. It's been one of the things AFG has certainly been concerned about for many, many years. We're concerned about that and things like NSPS. I guess it's Social Security you got to look at. How do you restore that fairness and transparency to merit promotions?
Well, the merit promotion process, since our last contract, the agency has unilaterally implemented a testing process. So if you file for a vacancy for a job, you have a questionnaire, and the questionnaire is scored based on your answers. And that has become the vehicle for being placed on a best qualified list or well-qualified list. The agency no longer looks at experience, how long you've done a particular job that may and obtain knowledge that would be required for the position that you're being promoted to. They don't look at your awards. Awards are meaningless right now in the merit promotion process on the agency system. They don't look at your training. They don't look at your education. They just look at the score on this questionnaire/test that they give you. And anyone who takes this questionnaire and test can tell by the way that questions are asked, if they do it a couple of times, that there's a certain answer that will lead to the best score. So it's simple to like game the system and just write the answer that the agency's looking for with regards to each of these questions. Now, the applications are machine scored, so there's no oversight on them. So if somebody's saying, I have experience in this area, the question's eliciting, have you done these kinds of tasks? And they say yes. There's no oversight. Nobody's looking at that and saying and trying to look at a sample of cases to say if people are telling the truth. And so they've increased the number of people on a well-qualified list. And what this system allows them to do is to basically promote whoever they want. Now, we've seen all kinds of abuses, and we are contemplating now, gathering evidence on filing a class action discrimination complaint regarding merit promotions, because it appears that the commissioner and the people who do the hiring in the agency are concentrating on younger workers to the exclusion of our veterans who work for the agency. We won an arbitration case on this whole system of merit that they've unilaterally implemented on merit promotion, and they filed an appeal, so they stayed the award, and they're still using this system that they unilaterally implemented. In the contract, they've put additional barriers up, geographic barriers and component barriers, where currently we have a open system where you can basically apply for any job in a country. Their proposal would be to eliminate that and to say you can only apply in certain geographic areas. You can't shift from one component to another. So, for instance, in Baltimore, where you have SSA headquarters, there's a lot of high-graded jobs. The people I represent work in field offices in Baltimore City and in the surrounding counties. Under the management's proposal, they would be prohibited from putting in for jobs in headquarters, and the headquarters people would be prohibited from putting in jobs in field offices when they might be in the same commute area. It makes no sense. But of course, we oppose all that, and we've proposed a more traditional merit promotion system where you have weights and factors, that you score things like experience, awards, education, training. So we're at loggerheads on that. We haven't agreed at all.
And, you know, everybody else in government's going towards hiring flexibility. This sounds like they're going towards hiring inflexibility. It doesn't seem to make any sense at all.
It's what they're trying to do is to be able to call the shots with very little, they don't want an agreement which would restrict their ability to promote whoever they felt like promoting. And our observation is in many cases, since they've implemented the system, there's been a lot of abuses. And we've seen things like relatives being promoted over other people, people that they associate with, like people in their fraternities or in their church clubs or whatever, getting promotions rather than qualified individuals under the merit promotion system. And we've had literally hundreds of complaints from employees about this kind of nepotism and cronyism that's going on in the merit promotion process in Social Security.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Attention AFGE members, did you know you have free access to all federal government job listings at your fingertips? Through AFGE's partnership with AVIEW Technologies, you can view all available jobs, apply online, and be notified when a position of interest to you becomes available. View your application progress online 24/7. You'll even get information to make you a better job applicant. Simplify your next career move with AVIEW Technologies. Log on today and check out current job openings at afge.us. That's www.afge.us and click register.
Some polls say Americans don't trust government. But listen to our members, the real people who work hard for you every day.
I'm Mike Schnobrick, a correctional officer at the Supermax in Florence, Colorado. Trust me, the terrorists are locked down tight.
My name is Janet Winghart, a Social Security claims rep in Fort Lauderdale. Senior citizens can trust me to get them the right check at the right time.
I'm Michelle Reed, a registered nurse at the Minneapolis VA Medical Center. Trust me, I care for our veterans like family.
My name is Everett Kelly. I work for the Anniston Army Depot, Anniston, Alabama. Trust me, our tanks are tough.
I'm John Gage, president of AFGE. You can trust us. We work for you. Brought to you by AFGE and online at afge.org.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at insidegovernmentradio.com. We've been joined by Joseph Friedel, a member of AFGE, Local 2798, coming to talk to us about things that are going on at the VA Canteen Service in his capacity as an AFGE local member. So welcome to Inside Government.
Thanks for having me on.
So tell us a little about what the VA Canteen Service is.
Well, the Veterans Canteen Service was established by Congress back in 1946 to run the cafeterias as well as general goods inside the VA medical centers across the nation. And what they do today is that's kind of morphed into the current operation, which still operates the cafeterias. They also operate retail stores in about 200 locations around the country and also in Puerto Rico. And they also operate the vending and several Starbucks locations inside the VA medical centers.
And what is your role with the service?
I have actually worked in several capacities. I originally started working for the VA and the canteen service back in 1999 in Dallas, Texas. I have worked as a receiving clerk. I've worked as a cashier. I've worked as a vending clerk. Pretty much the run-of-the-mill stuff. I've worked in almost every capacity that you can as an hourly employee.
And let's talk a little about this. Is it a non-profit operation?
It is non-profit, which means that all of the money made after paying salaries and overhead is returned to the VA.
And a big issue with the canteen service is the low pay of the employees. I mean, it would seem to me that if it's a non-profit, you probably should be paid considerably more than maybe people in the private sector doing the same kind of job, right?
Yeah, that's what I believe anyway. I recently wrote an article entitled The Federal Underclass that ran it in these times that was a product of about 6 months of research. I took pay rates from different localities around the nation In fact, I took the highest paid locality rates if not to cherry pick the lower ones. And what I found was when I took the average housing cost, in every case that I looked at, the employee, if they had either a dependent spouse or at least one child, would qualify for federal SNAP benefits, which is equivalent to food stamps, and would qualify for WIC.
Now, let me ask you, do the canteen employees, do they get any benefits, health care, or retirement or anything?
They do. We accrue health, like we accrue sick leave and annual leave like other federal employees. We also accrue, or we get FEHB, which is the health benefits. The big difference is the interchange agreement. For instance, trying to apply for other status jobs with other federal agencies. At this time, we can only apply for status jobs within the Veterans Health Administration.
Now, as you mentioned, this is a nonprofit, but is the activity at the canteen service, I mean, does it make a profit?
Actually, last year they made we did over $370 million in sales across the company. They also their operating budget, which was after they paid salaries and overhead, was about $28 million. Of that, $3 million, went directly back to the VA, there was also a lot of money that was donated to like Fisher House initiatives and some other stuff.
So minimally, there's at least $3 million that maybe some of that could have been done to do better by the employees.
Yeah, for instance, to pay the salaries of all the hourly employees, it only is about $7 to $8 million of the hourly employees, and that's not including management or people who are on the SES scale, the executives in St. Louis. There's a big pay parity issue. For instance, every canteen I've worked at, the canteen chief, who would be the store manager, is on average making about 4 to 5 times the salary of the hourly employees.
And what is AFGE doing to increase employee pay?
Well, there's not a lot they can do to increase direct pay, just because federal employees, their salaries are set, by federal law. But what AFGE has done, in fact, the National VA Council has just recently wrapped up negotiations for a new master agreement that is in the ratification stage. If it's passed, it includes something for canteen service that I thought was very smart on the part of the bargaining committee. What they've done is they've negotiated right now retail employees for the canteen service get a 50% discount on their lunches in the canteen. What the new contract would do was make that 100%, which it doesn't sound like a lot, but for each retail employee, it adds up to about $700 a year. So there's stuff like that that AFGE has been doing, and over the last several years, the VA Council actually has been very active in trying to improve benefits and pay for canteen employees.
Now, I know for a number of years, AFGE has been working to try to keep the VA from contracting out some of these jobs, and obviously, if they contracted them out, the pay would probably be even a little worse. You'd have no benefits at all. And the thing that seems to be lost is that many veterans actually work for the canteen service. Is that right?
That is correct. When I contacted central office of the canteen when writing the article I mentioned earlier, the figure I was given was that at least 50% of canteen employees are veterans. There's no way to verify that that was the number I was given by the canteen service itself. So they estimate 50% are veterans. And so, we believe that, that veterans and the people that care for them should be, paid, at least enough to, to have a living wage.
And, I mean, there have been definite studies on homelessness amongst veterans, and the rate of homelessness is obviously very high. There's a lot of adjustment for veterans when they come back with job skills and things like that. So it would seem that the canteen service, if it's hiring that many veterans, 50%, how large is the workforce?
The workforce right now is approximately 3,500 people.
So that's a fair number of folks that might be homeless, but for having the job opportunities at the canteen.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. I mean, I know that there are a number of veterans that I've worked with. Right now, there are 4 or 5 veterans in our location out of about, I would say, 35 to 40. But usually that number's been a little higher. In Dallas, I worked with, there were at least 10 or 15 on our staff that were veterans at any given time.
And did the canteen workers have the same general kind of workplace protections as other VA employees?
Actually, no. We don't enjoy some of the protections that Title V employees. Title V employees, which are most government workers on the general schedule, have the right to appeal a termination that they believe was unjust or for unfounded reasons. And they can go before the Merit Systems Protection Board and hear their, you know, they'll hear their case. And if they were fired without cause, a lot of times they'll be reinstated with back pay. As of the current time, the canteen service employees do not enjoy that protection. And so what's happened historically is that the canteen service has just terminated employees who, you know, have tried to lobby for better pay and better working conditions or who the department head may just not like.
And what's been the reaction since you've written this article?
Well, the canteen hasn't come out directly against me. But they, for the last year and a half, since I began to go public with lobbying for better pay, prior to that, I've always been a model employee, and that was backed up by my performance evaluations for several years until I went public and started lobbying for better working conditions. In the last year and a half, 2 years, I've been failed on one performance evaluation that was overturned by the Federal Labor Relations Authority. And I've had several write-ups and that sort of thing, the usual retaliation.
What about reaction from your fellow employees?
My coworkers have actually really liked the article. Obviously, I've had to be really discreet about showing it to them in the workplace, but the ones that have read it have been really receptive. I try to keep them abreast of the efforts that AFGE is making. And the canteen service actually has one of the highest dues-paying member percentages in the VA. So,
and let's talk a little about your background. Are you a veteran?
I am not, actually.
But do you have some organizing background?
I do. I attended the AFL-CIO Organizing Institute last year. I actually started in the labor movement trying to organize pizza delivery drivers several years ago and was actually terminated for that at one point. And I continue to be involved with the labor movement, and I operate a labor blog, and so I'm very involved.
Let's talk about the labor blog.
Sure. It's the Virtual Picket Line, which you can find at virtualpicketline.blogspot.com, where I talk about many different labor issues, but I try to focus a lot on low-paid workers. I do talk about I've talked about the federal pay freeze in recent days. That's one of the main things I've been focusing on.
So tell us a little about the pay freeze. What's been your thoughts on that?
Well, the pay freeze, I mean, to me seems like it's very much a political football. One of the things that I talked about on my blog was that if you cut the salary of every member of the House from their current salary of $177,000 to $100,000 for a year, it's the same equivalent of freezing the pay of 96,000 federal employees that are making $30,000 to $40,000.
And you know, you wonder back in history, I mean, there was talk of freezing both, I guess, the pay, but also the prices of things and, you know, just having an overall freeze. I remember back in the Nixon years, they talked about doing this and did some of those kinds of things. Do you think, though, with inflation being as low as it is, was there any need for a pay freeze?
No. And the thing is that, you know, a 2% cost of living increase is only 38 cents an hour for somebody making $40,000. Because the cost of living raises that are being frozen, those are calculated on percentage of wages. And the vast majority of federal employees, and certainly the rank-and-file union members that are not management, the money savings don't come from freezing their pay. It comes from freezing the pay of workers who are on the SES executive scale.
And as we come into our last minute, let's highlight that for a second. You're saying 38 cents an hour is what the pay freeze amounts to for...
For a federal employee who's making $40,000 a year, an average pay increase would be 2%. It's 38 cents an hour.
Versus giving tax breaks to multi-billionaires.
Oh, exactly.
Which obviously is taking a lot more money off the table than 38 cents an hour. Would that be right?
Exactly. And if Congress were really serious about saving money in the budget, these are members of the House, most of them are independently wealthy. And so cutting their salary, you know, to $100,000, which I think is still overpaid, I mean, that's the equivalent of freezing 96,000 federal employees, and that's only 435 people.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Save 10, 20, even 30% on PCs from Dell. Only Dell can offer AFGE members the guaranteed lowest price through their member purchase program. Visit Dell.com/AFGE for details.
Attention AFGE members, did you know you have free access to all federal government job listings at your fingertips? Through AFGE's partnership with AVIEW Technologies, you can view all available jobs, apply online, and be notified when a position of interest to you becomes available. View your application progress online 24/7. You'll even get information to make you a better job applicant. Simplify your next career move with AVIEW Technologies. Log on today and check out current job openings at AFGE.us. That's www.afge.us and click register.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm joined by Tim McManus, Vice President for Education and Outreach for the Partnership for Public Service. Welcome to Inside Government.
Good to be here, Ward.
So, a lot going on these past couple of weeks. President Obama took office in 2009. He said he was going to make a commitment to make government cool again. You know, the past couple of weeks we've been seeing pay freezes, obviously the tragedy out in Tucson. You know, what are we to make of all this?
Yeah, I think we're actually really seeing some mixed signals in terms of what all of this means. Certainly, you know, feds have come under fire more than ever, from pay freezes to talk of furloughs to shutting down government, to the incident in Arizona. At the same time, as you mentioned, President Obama came in saying that he wanted to make government cool. I think, in some respects, the administration has actually taken some really good strides in trying to improve the hiring system, trying to get young workers into federal government in a way that is conducive to them and really does in fact try to position government as a prestigious and honorable place to work.
But with a 2-year pay freeze, I mean, the new people that come in, the first thing they're seeing out of the box is you're not going anywhere for 2 years.
Well, I think that's actually one of the difficulties here is you can't simply focus on getting people in the door and saying we're going to make government cool and we're going to make it cool by increasing the number of folks who are eligible and can get into the Presidential Management Fellows Program by focusing on internships and, as you said, then Ward, on the other side of the coin, say, but we're actually going to there's going to be pay freezes. It's going to be harder, more difficult than ever to get into government to begin with because we're only going to fill 2 positions for every 3 that become available. You can't work both sides of the coin on this. And I think that's really where those mixed signals are coming in, which is trying to open up government, trying to make it an attractive place to work, an employer of choice. And at the same time, what we hear every time we turn on the radio, every time we pick up the newspaper is that, feds are lazy, feds are bureaucratic, feds are making too much. And by the way, feds aren't going to get paid anymore. They have to suffer along with everyone else. And that's going to solve all of our country's woes.
And certainly also the discussion about not filling vacancies. I mean, when you come into office and you see what your workload is, and then all of a sudden you're being told, by the way, in addition to this pay freeze, as you mentioned, not filling some of these vacancies, is that going to be really devastating, not just to bring in new people, but for the people that are there?
We certainly think it's devastating for everybody involved. It's particularly if it's not done strategically. So if the conversation is simply about let's only hire two people for every 3 vacancies that comes about, what does that mean for programs and services that serve the American people as well? So certainly devastating, I think, for the job seeker. Well, is there really an opportunity for me to get in government? Is this a really, really uphill battle for me to try to get in, and is it worth that time, effort, everything else to get in? For those who are in government, clearly, you know, what does that say to them? Does it say your work is undervalued or not valued at all? You have to pick up and carry more of the water in this case. And then again, I think, you know, to the American people, If you don't backfill behind positions that are actually critical to delivering services to the American people, what does that mean as well? So, you know, Ward, during the election season, there was a quote that was going around a lot that from some American citizens who said, you know, around government, and the conversation went something like this: you know, I don't want government in my life. I simply want my Medicare check. Those two things don't equate. Your Medicare check actually does come from government. You need good people in those jobs who are actually making that happen. So I think there's actually ramifications across the board for the job seeker, for those who are currently in those positions, for the American public, and ultimately for government achieving its goals as well.
And let's talk a little about the pay freeze. Will it actually reduce the deficit by any substantial amount?
Well, you know, the estimates for reduction based on the pay freeze is about $26 billion over 5 years. So, you know, is that some money? Clearly, is it going to substantially reduce the deficit? Absolutely not. And again, I think particularly when you start talking about pay freezes across the board, and all of these moves seem to be taking an axe to the system rather than to take a scalpel and say, where are there things that could legitimately be cut? Would a better approach, rather than sending the signal to all federal employees, both current and future federal employees, that we have to freeze your pay, would a more effective way to solving that be a much more strategic look at programs and services that the government is now delivering to say, is this actually something that we need to be involved in? Are there better, more efficient, more effective ways to actually deliver that product or service? And in doing that, could we cut or reduce the deficit even more?
And you know, federal employees certainly seem to feel like they're being thrown into this political debate. And I mean, when you look at it and you talk about what it, you know, the $26 billion over 5 years, and you look at during the same time frame, tax cuts to billionaires and the rhetoric out there of, well, government needs to sort of live within its means. There doesn't seem to be a contrary argument of maybe billionaires need to live within their means.
Well, yeah, again, I think, you know, certainly we'd make an argument, you know, across the board that given tough financial times, everybody actually has to hunker down a little bit. But you've got to do that in a way that doesn't create long-term turmoil or further challenges. So again, not only, you know, what we talked about earlier, and I think, you know, certainly there are a lot of different ways that you could probably quite easily find that $26 billion over the 5 years. We talked about impact of pay freeze and hiring freezes on both prospective job seekers and also on current. One of the things that we didn't touch on, Ward, was, you know, how many of those folks who actually have been hanging on and saying, you know, I like my work. I'm still feeling like I'm contributing to a really good cause. I'm being really productive. I like what my agency is doing. I'm going home feeling good about myself. Now are saying, you know, they're retirement eligible, and they're saying, you know what, this is no longer worth it to me. How much good talent are we actually losing? Not simply the morale issue of those who are deciding, you know, yes, we're going to tough it out. There are going to be better times ahead. But what about that really good talent who says, you know what, it's just no longer worth it for me. I'm actually going to throw in the towel. And particularly when you couple that with attitudes then from job seekers that, wow, this might not be the best place to work. That really sets us up in a really, really difficult position if we're losing some of that great talent, great experience, and great knowledge and understanding about how some of these programs, how some of the services are actually delivered.
And, you know, that raises a really good issue. I mean, a lot of attention has been paid to talking about how do we attract the best and brightest to government, but how about how do we retain the best and brightest that are already there in government? What are we doing to incentivize these folks to stay?
Yeah, and Ward, I think, you know, that's going to become more and more of an issue, I think, with this right now 2-year pay freeze. You know, there's talk maybe that goes beyond 2 years, maybe it's a 3-year pay freeze, who knows. But, you know, we are starting to see some signs of some economic recovery in the private sector. There was a recent survey from Aon Hewitt that actually surveyed top employers, and the vast majority of those top employers said that they actually expected less than 12% of them said that they expected to do any type of pay freeze or layoffs in the coming year. So, you know, as the private sector starts to hum, and let's hope that that humming noise starts sooner rather than later. But as that happens, there's going to be more competition again. You know, for a good portion of the last couple of years, government has really been kind of in the driver's seat. It has been the place where people have actually looked for employment. But when you couple all the things that we've talked about, it really makes it difficult to not only attract that, but also to hang on to the talent that we have. And we really can't forget about the great talent that's really in there. And I think that's actually something that you opened with, Ward, which is, you know, it's not simply the pay freezes. It's not simply talks of furloughs and everything else that are really denigrating to current employees, but it's the rhetoric that government is too big, that government is too bureaucratic, that government doesn't get things done. All of that leads to a real issue of attrition of talented staff and morale.
And do you think some of this is maybe people don't really know all the things that government does? I mean, when people talk about firefighters, police, and teachers at the state and local level, people maybe can get their hands around that. But the federal level, it may be lost when you start thinking about, well, okay, the EPA, I mean, they're keeping your air and water clean. You know, whether it's the Bureau of Prisons and they're keeping us safe from, you know, violent felons. I mean, do people really want less protection from that? I mean, I don't sense that that's really what people want.
Yeah, and I think that's where, you know, my earlier comment, Ward, about, you know, the quote that someone had made about, you know, I don't want government in my business. I simply want my Medicare check. I mean, those two things don't sync up. So I think you're right that most Americans actually don't have an understanding and therefore don't have an appreciation for what the federal government actually does. So their view of federal workers or their view of government workers are, in fact, the police officer, the post office, you know, things of that sort that they see on an everyday basis. What they don't see is, you know, one of the examples that we frequently give here at the partnership is one of our Service to America Medals award winners several years ago was someone from the FCC who actually designed and implemented the Do Not Call list. You know, the fact that Americans can sit down to dinner with their family at 5 o'clock or at 7 o'clock in the evening and not get 10 different calls while they're trying to eat, that's actually a direct reflection on the effectiveness of government to make life better for the American people.
And really, as we look towards even some of the initiatives that President Obama's put out there in terms of financial reform, fight against terrorism, health care, I mean, aren't we going to need a strong federal workforce to do all these initiatives?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, you know, I think all of the three areas that you touched upon are absolutely crucial. And as you look at this, the size, both the size of government and also the number of hires that have been made, even in the recent past, most of those have actually synced up directly with administration and the priorities of this country. So a lot of those hires have been within the Department of Defense, within the Department of Homeland Security. Again, pressing on those issues of terrorism and safety and security. So absolutely, and again, I would hope, certainly it's my opinion that whoever's working in government, I want the best darn people working there on behalf of me to make sure that I'm safe, to make sure that when I get on a plane next week, that I don't have to be concerned about getting on that airplane.
I want to say thank you to our guests this week, AFGE, National Council of SSA Field Operations Locals President, Vitol Skrivdachinsky, Local 2798 member, Joseph Rydell, and Partnership for Public Service Vice President of Education and Outreach, Tim McManus. And that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power, Dell, and AV Technologies.